Well, good evening and welcome to this term's public lecture for the Gender Institute. I'm delighted this evening to welcome Professor Mary Evans, who is the Professor of Women's Studies at the University of Kent at Canterbury. She's been teaching women's studies there since 1980. Her main research interests are in the European literature of the 19th and 20th century. She's published books on Jane Austen and Simone de Beauvoir. She's just published a new edition of The Woman Question, and we're very lucky to have her here tonight to give a lecture on the theme of moralizing women and moralizing about women. Now, Professor Evans will talk, she tells me, for about 45 minutes, and then she'd be very happy to take comments and questions. And of course, as usual, you will all be very welcome upstairs on the fifth floor for a glass of wine afterwards. So I welcome Mary Evans.
Right. Well, thank you very much, Henrietta, for that introduction, and thank you for inviting me to come and speak here this afternoon. As the title of my lecture this evening suggests, what I want to talk about is the issue of morality and women's relationship to morality. I want to do this in the context of the present political climate in this country. And so what I will be doing, we'll be talking about this issue very much in terms of British politics in 1994. So let me start by saying then something about this context and something about the issue as I see it at present. By the context of British politics at the moment, the particular context on which I want to focus is, of course, the very obvious one, the explicit attack on single mothers, which has been made by members of this present government. John Redwood and Peter Lilly have both been unstinting in the harshness of remarks which they've made about those women who live in different dissenting family situations, different and dissenting from the kinds of families which those two individuals think are appropriate. But I don't want to single out two individuals for particular attack here, though I think their attacks are in themselves worthy of comment. What I want to look at much more, and what I want to see as a much more important part of the context, is the moral fundamentalism of sections of both political parties and the impact which this kind of moral fundamentalism, the kind of back to basics across the political spectrum, has on women in particular. I also, as part of this context, want to look at what I see as the refusal of the Western media and the dominant culture within that media to depart from an ideology of the hero. And so part of what I want to say will also be related to the way in which the mass media hangs on to the idea of the hero in the late 20th century, because this, it seems to me, is also an important part of the context in which we discuss and construct morality. The third point which I want to raise and talk about is the difficulty which it seems to me there is for women of being assessed in any other terms than the sexual. That is to say, very much in terms of their status and their behaviour within heterosexual relationships and within the context of heterosexual couples, heterosexual relationships of one kind and another. And again, to refer to the mass media, this has become strikingly clear in the last 2 years in the ways in which women involved with particular individuals are discussed and constructed in public. What seems to be an inescapable association, as far as women are concerned, is the relationship between their sexual behaviour and the construction of them as moral beings. The implication of this, then, is it is extremely difficult if we are to construct citizens in moral terms, for women to shed this issue of their sexual behaviour as part of that construction. So that identity, that construction, that relationship also seems to me to be one which it is worth discussing. And then the fourth point that I'm concerned with, and which I think is of interest, is that of the problem in our culture of representing femininity, the problem of how to give the feminine a presence, how to allow women a voice in public and indeed a presence in public, which is not communicated either through exclusion or absence. Now, this has two dimensions to it. It has the symbolic dimension, that is to say, how is woman as a sign going to be constructed within a culture which, in many ways, takes the masculine as the dominant symbol. And the second, although obviously very closely related aspect to this issue, is how to represent women in a public space in which that public space, in empirical terms, has until relatively recently been largely dominated by men. Now, clearly these two things have a very close relationship. Women have been absent from politics, absent from public life, absent from public citizenship, if you like, in this country throughout the West. They have not been absent as symbols. I mean, they have played for a long time a very powerful part in the symbolic culture. But that part in the symbolic culture has very often, and I would argue very largely, been mediated through masculinity. That is to say, representing the feminine remains a problem and a difficulty for the culture. So both these two things, and the symbolic and the empirical, interact and have an impact on how it's actually possible for our culture and our society to allow women a presence. And of course, one of the ways, the point of these remarks, one of the ways in which it tends to solve this issue is by saying, well, we will see women in sexual terms, we will see them only in that particular dimension, and we will relate that aspect of behaviour to other aspects of their lives. So, in short, what I think these points add up to and what this context adds up to is an alienation of women from the social fabric of our society. Now, we know this empirically, and I think increasingly we know it symbolically as well. And what I want to therefore go on to do is look at both the history and the contemporary relationship of women and men to morality. How have we arrived at this situation in which women, femininity, are such an absent presence, if you like, such a non-participator in the construction of the moral order? Well, the first part of the history of the relationship of women to morality, I think, is that in the West, men have largely done, as it were, the moral work for women. Now, this hasn't necessarily always or exclusively been the case. But there is a pattern in bourgeois Western societies in which societies follow the model of much ado about nothing. That is to say, Benedict, at Beatrix's request, goes off to defend the honour of the heroine. That model, that women instigate action on the part of men, seems to me to be very much a predominant one. It is not that women are divorced from morality, but what they do is send out people, i.e. men, to act on their behalf. And of course, within that play, we have another aspect of women's relationship to morality, which I think, again, is a very striking and has been a very consistent one. And that is that Hero faints at the threat to her honour, when her public honour is, as it were, violated, when she is publicly confronted with information which seems to challenge her construction as, quote, a good woman. What she does is to opt out of that situation. And, of course, what is presented there is what has for centuries been the conventional expectations about female response to moral difficulty. If it's impossible to deal with an issue, then women faint, scream, swoon, get ill, go mad rather than get mad. The point is that one device or another, they opt out. They do not say, I don't accept this morality, I don't accept this construction. What they do is, in effect, both literally and symbolically, leave the stage. Unless, and I wouldn't think that this is either a peculiarly English or British pattern either, because in the 17th centuries, in the dramas of Racine, the heroines typically feel forced by patterns of morality to die. They do not turn around and say, well, I'm sorry about this, you may think this, but as far as I'm concerned, this is not going to be part of the ways in which I resolve this problem. They say, I cannot deal with this situation. If my honour is to be saved, I must die. It is the only way out for me. And that leaving a situation without challenge is, I think, part of what has had to be for women very much the structured response to moral issues and moral dilemmas. That is to say, ask others, ask men, to act as your moral agent, or if that isn't a possibility, then what is a possibility, and what is an open and a socially acceptable possibility, is leave that situation in one way and another, opt out in another way. Now, of course, I would emphasize about this that these examples which I've suggested are from bourgeois high culture. And so these responses, it might be possible to say, represent a bourgeois response to questions of individual morality. No doubt that comment is an important one. And clearly what we know about the past and the present is that different groups in society had different ways of resolving moral questions. But basically, I would still argue that honour codes existed across all classes in Western societies in which men acted to protect the sexual honour of women. Except, of course, in those millions of cases in which they were actively engaged in undermining it. Therefore, what we have at the same time as men as agents of morality and the orderers, if you like, of female behaviour, is the active creation by that structure of the double standard of sexual morality of the West, that the gender protecting the morality of a group of women is also the gender who is involved in creating the fallen women of Western society and Western literature. Now, I said that this was a general pattern. I didn't want to suggest, and I did say that I didn't think that this was an exclusive pattern. And so I do want at this point to say that there are obviously cases in the 19th, just as much as in the 20th century, when women have asserted moral autonomy, where they have not waited for men to be their agents. The obvious example in the 19th century is Josephine Butler's campaign against the Contagious Diseases Act, where she acted not unilaterally and not just as a representative of women, but she became an active public agent and intervened very explicitly in debates about sexual morality. But to set aside this, I think it's also important to remember that very often when women did do this, when they did say, I am going to act publicly, I am going to assert a set of rights, what they had to do, as Linda Gordon and other historians of the 19th century have pointed out, is to distance themselves from their own sexuality, so that the cost of social action was sexual activity. politics, the desire on the battleground was impossible for the great women campaigners of the 19th century. So that association then of women and sexual activity was so strong in the 19th century, and I would argue still in the 20th century, that the only possible way for women to assert social and moral autonomy was through the desexualization of their person, that they did not have a public space in which to act unless they very explicitly presented themselves and put themselves forward to the public as beyond, above, not part of ordinary patterns of sexual and usually heterosexual activity. Now, at the same time as the West has, I think, articulated this pattern between morality and sexuality, what the West has also maintained and hung on to almost to grim death is the vision of the hero. And it does seem to me that the issue of the hero, the importance of the hero, is one of central importance in Western culture. It is, of course, a model which has existed in our culture for centuries. What we also ought to, I think, say about it is that it is a model which in many cases has been as contentious for men as it might be for women or for distance generally. From the late 19th century onwards in this country, there is a tradition of men who contest the idea of the great male hero, the great white hero of imperialism. Kipling, Orwell, Leonard Woolf, all these were men who said, no, I do not fit into this model of the imperial hero. I am not part of this pattern which you are constructing about masculinity. And in the 1930s, the Auden generation again exerted a powerful impulse towards the deconstruction of heroic masculinity. That Auden, McNeice, Spender, again Orwell, and I think to a very large extent Graham Greene and Evelyn Waugh, all contested the notion of the good white male imperial hero. They turned round and said to the culture in various kinds of ways and through various kinds of mediums, look, this particular form of heroism doesn't exist, it's a fantasy, it is not appropriate. And if you want to construct a morality, which I think is also the theme which they were much concerned with, you have to do so through ways other than through this kind of empty hero. So what they are saying is to contest the notion that this white imperial hero contains the morality of their society. And they're saying, as Graham Greene said, as Evelyn Waugh said, look, maybe heroes are journalists who eat people. Maybe heroes are people who do all kinds of things which in other ways are socially not acceptable. Maybe heroism is not such a simple moral matter as this culture supposes. Maybe there is a diversity here which we have yet to explore. And so in this tradition of contesting this notion, we see that this model of masculinity becomes, by 1939, one which is seriously contested and very seriously challenged. But, and I stopped deliberately in 1939, because it seems to me that, to a very large extent, the Second World War reinvented the hero for the West. And it doesn't seem to me either to be any surprise that at the present time, the return to D-Day, the return to the Second World War, actually creates political dissent, political discussion, political debate. Now, when I say that masculinity got a good name in the Second World War, it got a good name because there was a widespread conviction, and there remains a widespread conviction, that the Second World War was just, it was a good war. And that men fighting it were soldiers on the right side. It was not a morally ambiguous war in the same sense as the great imperial wars of the 19th century. Men fighting it, therefore, could be expected to be thought of as good in a moral sense. And so masculinity received, at the same time, a good press, doing what men did, which was be soldiers, suffer, be killed, fight. All that became acceptable in a culture which by 1939 had, I think, been becoming increasingly sceptical about that model of heroism, that model of masculinity. And so the moral authority of the West becomes, by 1945, associated with masculinity. That is to say, this is here are good men doing good things. And if you look at, in fact, the publications during the war, if you look at the kinds of literature produced, what you see is, in fact, women being asked to be good soldiers. That is to say, there is a spillage from the good moral man into the good woman at home. Our men are fighting and suffering abroad, therefore women should be expected and should expect to act like this at home. So this war, the war years, the 1939 to 1945 period, has, I think, a revivalist effect as far as the hero is concerned. And it still remains, very obviously, an appealing time for people to go back to, because the fantasy is, if only we can return to that age, then we can rediscover realities about masculinity, realities about men's place in society. Part of the problem, of course, for conservative returns to that time is that there was a very powerful populist ideology as well as a very powerful masculinist ideology. So the return is a very double-edged one. But of course, in the 1960s and the 1970s, as everybody points out, this kind of moral singularity about masculinity, this model of the good West, the good soldier, had collapsed and had become very much more diffuse, very much more diverse. And yet, in the dream factories of the West, the hero still lives on and still lives out this version of heroic possibilities. I want to take two examples to illustrate this. Two recent, very popular films, both Oscar winners, both straight out of the dream factory of Hollywood. The first is Clint Eastwood's Unforgiven, and the second is Steven Spielberg's Schindler's List. And what I want to say relates, in both cases, to the part of the hero in these films. In Unforgiven, we're presented at the beginning of the film with a hero who is going seriously as a hero downhill. He's become a house husband, and the director makes it very clear that this kind of feminine role is no place for a man. In order to regain his masculinity, what he has to become is a hired gun. I mean, he becomes the shooting, avenging hero of the film. And he does so in order to avenge the honour of women. I mean, it is a classic piece within the Western tradition that here is a man yet again going out to avenge the honour of women. But what I think is interesting about this film, and the reason to discuss it here, is that what the hero does is to contest the adequacy of civil law. Because what the film becomes is a battle between the law of the hero and the civil law of the society of which the sheriff represents. And of course, in the end, we have a duel between two men. We have a duel between Eastwood and the sheriff. And so we have a hero, but we also have a hero acting, and I think this is significant and something worth attention. Eastwood is actually saying to us, the public, look, the hero is above civil society. And it is no accident that in the United States it is in civil society and in the law of civil society that the voice of women is becoming stronger and is becoming more of a presence. So that the film, in a sense, is very, very much a return to everything that has existed in the last 300 years in the West about the hero, a person above society, and above, and increasingly as well, a man who is contesting that feminized civil space. That man is actually saying, look at civil society. It doesn't have laws which are worth regarding. And after all, look who is becoming active there. The second film which I mentioned, which I'll say something briefly about, is Spielberg's Schindler's List. The point of talking about this hero is that, of course, the hero is an unfaithful husband. And this issue of the unfaithful husband is one which is quite clearly located as irrelevant. It doesn't actually matter what this man's relationships with women are like in terms of his heroic presence. And, of course, Schindler does become, in one sense, a hero. But what Hollywood refuses in this film is the strength which Schindler takes from responsibility for others. What Hollywood does with this character is to make him into a hero, in which, as I've suggested, how he acts towards women doesn't matter. But what it also refuses is, in a sense, the subtext in which it is possible to take strength, to take moral stature from responsibilities held towards other people. Precisely the message which feminists have been attempting to communicate to the West for the last 20 years, that it is only through collective responsibility, only through ties to others, that we actually attain any kind of moral stature of any sort. And so that point of the contribution, that thinking about mothering, that thinking about this issue of ties to others, that brings me to another theme, a third theme here, which is that of work on that issue of mothering, which has been done by feminists, again, within the last 20 or 25 years. Because what this points to, it seems to me, and what this provides a very important empirical basis for, is this issue about how women achieve moral understanding and moral capacity. Part of the work on mothering has been very closely related to studies of adolescent girls. And one of the recurrent themes in that literature is the difficulty which adolescent girls have in negotiating a public person. In Carol Gilligan, in Valerie Hay, in Caroline Steadman, in Valerie Walkerdine, in Angela McRobbie, in a whole number, and I think what is now a tradition of work in women's studies, in feminism, on adolescents and girls, what has emerged is the very real problem that girls have for negotiating a sexual and a social person. And that the difficulty which they move with and through is maintaining, particularly strong one in our culture, maintaining heterosexual availability and desirability at the same time as maintaining heterosexual exclusivity. And this bind of being both available and yet not available is, of course, one which very often traps adolescent girls in a sexual morality. That is to say that what becomes their person is their performance, their behaviour, within one aspect of social life. At the same time as this work has been done within feminism, so other feminist writers have concentrated on the value of motherhood as a moral experience, and in effect, in certain cases, made motherhood into the defining moral experience in our culture. That is to say, it is through being a mother that those adolescent girls, that women, acquire moral status, acquire the capacity to care for others. In that literature or about that literature, there is considerable contest, there is considerable debate, because obviously many women would find that an unacceptably essentialist position. They would not want to take up that particular point of view. But what both those traditions, those sets of literature, seem to me to be about the same issue, that issue of how to be evaluated, how to construct a social person. That is to say, how to become and how to maintain, how to develop a moral presence, and a moral presence that, as I say, is not directly related to sexual behaviour. Now, in some cases, there are a variety of ways in which women answer this dilemma. First of all, they assert entirely traditional values, like those women conservatives in Norfolk who question Tim Yeo's interpretation of events. Women turn round and say, well, for us, there are certain core values, there are certain points on which we have very clear views, and this is what they are. That is to say, they assert a traditional set of values about women's place in the home, about women's place within marriage, and about men's relationship to marriage as well. A very straightforward and very clear sets of values about the family and marriage. All of it, of course, constructed within heterosexual expectations. The second way round this dilemma of what women should be and how can they, in a sense, move through this moral maze to achieve a personhood is to assert the success ethic. And I think, in a sense, that is the kind of solution which Camille Paglia has chosen to take. That is to say that look at men are successful, that is the way forward, that is how to be, and that is the model to which women should aspire. It is, of course, a version of market freedom. I mean, it is exactly like women who say, well, it doesn't matter whether I'm married and have not married and have children. The point is that I'm not dependent on the state. And the whole issue is constructed in terms of not being a dependent of the welfare state, of the welfare society. The third way out of this double bind, this impossible situation, is for women to explicitly assert their sexuality. It's the if you've got it, flaunt it model, which argues that this is a way forward, this is a form of liberation for women. And of course that case has been made about Madonna and other women who in public places and public dimensions have modelled themselves on that pattern. I would argue that all that does, in fact, is trap women even further in the sexual and in traditional patterns of sexuality. That is not an escape. It is a particular construction, but there is nothing about it that constitutes liberation. So all this, then, seems to me to add up to a very considerable moral maze. And the point is that it's a very well-documented moral maze. We know empirically that adolescence is a difficult time for girls. It's a time in which they very often do less well in school. It's a time in which they make certain kinds of choices which have a real impact on their lives. And it does seem to me that what is going on there, what is actually a very real problem, is this issue of how to construct a moral person, how to be a public person. But, of course, that moral person and that public person is inherently gendered. And the pattern to becoming the kind of person which society finds acceptable, the kind of person which society is willing to support, is one which I think is still different for the two sexes. But at the same time as I think this is the case, it also seems to me that one of the great strengths of women is very often that they avoid morality. Now, this may sound like a curious paradox, but it seems to me that in terms of contributions to what is good, what is bad in our society, particularly about morality and particularly about sexual morality, the most vehement public statements, and certainly I think this is the case in the last 10 years, have come from men rather than women. That if we actually look for the statements about what is right or wrong, what is acceptable, we find them coming from one group rather than another. Now, we find them coming from relatively unsophisticated sources, of course, the redwoods and the lilies, which I mentioned at the beginning of this lecture. But what I want to conclude by suggesting is that the construction of morality, of what matters in morality, is also very often misread by very, very much more sophisticated people than the particular contemporary cases which I had mentioned. And I want to conclude these remarks by looking at the case of Edward Said and on Jane Austen, because it seems to me to illuminate much about the construction of morality in our society. Now, in Said's extraordinary collection of essays, Culture and Materialism, in one of the essays, he attacks Jane Austen for her lack of discussion of the slave trade, or the explicit discussion of the slave trade, in Mansfield Park. Now, when he wrote this, he was, of course, attacked vehemently by all the Janeites in English literature. I mean, for somebody to say this was almost like sacrilege. How could anyone attack Jane Austen? Everyone knows she's a great writer about social codes and social conventions. How crass to say that she doesn't talk about the outside world, etc., etc. So that was the general, as it were, the general nature of the critique of Said. Yet it seems to me that there's another way of approaching this question, and perhaps a helpful approach, and that is to say, well, it's not that Jane Austen doesn't actually address issues about the state and morality, but she addresses them in ways which are so sharp and so focused that this is completely unacceptable and untenable anyway. And I would take two examples to illustrate this. At the beginning of Sense and Sensibility, her discussion, or her telling of the discussion between the Dashwoods about how much money is to be given to the widowed Mrs. Dashwood. Now, in that passage, the Dashwoods finally convince themselves, after about two pages, that they needn't actually give the widowed Mrs. Dashwood anything. I mean, it is more or less explicit Thatcherism. They virtually say that this woman brought about her husband's death, and therefore it is her fault that she is in poverty. As a talking away of charity and concern, I think it is one of the strongest pieces of writing which English fiction has. And not to recognise it is to refuse to recognise a very powerful, explicit critique of the market economy. I mean, all right, there's no discussion of the slave trade, but the critique is there. And what Jane Austen is doing as a woman is recognising the effects on women of a process. She is not talking about the morality of the process. She is not talking about the specifics of it. She's actually talking about the impact which that process, that system, can have on individual lives. The second example which I would take is from Mansfield Park, the novel which Said is particularly concerned with. And it is, in fact, Fanny Price's consistent resistance throughout that book to patriarchal authority, that she stands completely alone and unsupported, and virtually by herself asserts her own moral autonomy. She points, and she actually dares to say, at a time when it was socially unacceptable and socially difficult, that she has rights in the situation, and the authority of the male head of the household is not absolute and should not be taken for granted. She also recognises, and Austin allows Fanny Price to recognise, the appeal of fantasy, for men and for male characters. The villain of Mansfield Park, the character called Henry Crawford, says at one point in the novel that he was never so alive as when acting in a play. Now, the play in which he, in the play in point in that novel, what Crawford is doing is acting out an incestuous relationship. The whole point of the play and Austin's condemnation of it, or her implicit condemnation of it, is that what is being acted out there is a set of incestuous and unacceptable and unsanctioned relationships. So what Austin has recognised, and this is why I think recognising and discussing the slave trade is actually neither here nor there, is both the material impact which social systems have on women. She has recognised a real moral, she's taken a real moral stance in that novel and said, look, let's look at the process. Never mind about the ideology of the process, because after all, the ideology of the process is what the Dashwoods are using to take away help and support. Let's actually look at that process and see the effects that it has on people. She's also prepared to take on the symbolic culture and say, well, let's look at that as well and see how that potentially damages relationships and forces people into situations which they would not perhaps have freely chosen. So those examples seem to me, and there are obviously others, many others in Jane Austen's work, to add up to, as it were, a model of moral discussion, a model which, as I say, looks at process rather than at ideology. Austen is writing at a time before the Victorian construction of the hero, before the construction of the helpless woman, before the construction of femininity and masculinity in 19th and 20th century models. And that kind of clear-eyed articulation of process rather than ideology about morality seems to me to be a very important and a very powerful one. We, I think, in 1994, have still to escape from our ideological heritage of the past 100, 150 years. The double standard, particular constructions of masculinity and femininity, we are still, in a sense, contesting those. They constitute for us our moral maze. And one way out of that, of course, is to construct other moralities and say, no, no, we've got to find a new morality for 1994. We've got to return to basics, or we've got to do something else. We've got to have a return to religion, etc., etc. My argument and the conclusion, the point where I would like to conclude, is that those constructions are only really to avoid the issues. The issues are those of process and not of construction. And it is there, and I think it is in novels of the early 19th century, where we might look for our guides to the constructions of morality for women. Thank you.
Wonderful, thank you. Now we have time for some comments and some questions. Would anyone like to make a comment or ask a question? Demas.
Yes, I mean, I take your point about the need to look at the process and a clear view of what is actually going on and how it's the social system affects women, but as a political philosopher, it seems to me that there's seminar series or series of talks at the Center for the Philosophy of the Social, Natural and Social Sciences, which was on themes unknown, where gender was not mentioned once as an issue. Although, of course, for Mill it was a big issue. And it just seems to me that you may not really understand, well, you may not do justice to the need that a lot of feminist moral and political philosophers or theorists feel to actually intervene in the discourse that is very male dominated, and to do that by looking at, you know, alternative moralities, which most of us don't actually see as necessarily related to gender. We see it as accidentally related to gender, i.e., it just so happens that women were made to be carers and therefore have a socially constructed to be carers, and therefore have a different perspective on sort of issues, individual as well as social. But that's not necessarily the case. And if society were to change such that both men and women were to take on the care of others, then morality of care would cease to be gendered. I think the charge of essentialism is a quick way of sort of, you know, dismissing those attempts at coming up with the sort of head-on intervention in you know, mainstream moral and political philosophy. And it seems to me that actually it's really that kind of head-on attack is as sorely needed as the attempt to find other ways of intervening successfully. And I was just wondering whether you could comment on that. And the second very short question I have was, I'm not quite sure what you meant by saying that the success of women in society depended on a refusal to engage in moral questions or in morality. I'm not quite sure I understood you well there, but you seem to say, before you went into the Edward Said point, that it was mainly men who made pronouncements on morality and women were much more successful when pursuing.
No, I didn't wish to, I wasn't talking about success or lack of success. They were just much less, I mean, partly it's, I mean, related to the first part of your question is that they have much less public access to make remarks about morality. I mean, that if, you know, that they don't occupy the public space. So if they make remarks, it doesn't actually matter. But I know it wasn't about being more or less successful. It just doesn't seem to me to be so much a part of, you know, what women do.
But,
well, again, you see, I think then you would have to say, well, how ought they to, I mean, it goes back to what you were saying in the first part of your question, is how are they to do it? I mean, in one sense, yes, of course they ought to intervene, there ought to be a feminist presence, a presence of women, or whatever. But to go where? To answer which questions? I mean, to achieve which ends? And maybe, I mean, you know, you talked about the ways in which there were, you know, new, as it were, coalitions within politics, which are not divisions between men and women, but were about people joining together with the same interests. I mean, obviously, that's been going on for generations, and so what we see today is only a sort of continuity of that. But I do think you have to ask the question of, well, if you're going to have interventions, that's fine. But then that, as it were, changes the numbers. What is also going to be the nature of those interventions?
Yeah,
I mean, it would seem to me that in political science, I mean, one of the areas that needs contesting is the question of, you know, who is the citizen? What is the nature of the nature of the division between the public and the private? I mean, which is an age-old construction of our society, and one which I think on the whole has worked to the disadvantage of women. It's been very convenient to say that's private, because you can keep all kinds of things and a large group of the population within it. So it might, for example, be important to intervene in terms of those debates. Who is the citizen and what is public and what is private? I mean, on that latter issue, there would seem to me to be a lot of scope for intervention at the moment, precisely because the issue has become such a complex one that, you know, that people simply don't know where what's public and what's private, in a sense.
I think we've got another question. Mick.
I want to take issue. I enjoyed the general thesis and the argument, the way in which you constructed it. But I wanted to take issue partly with your very rapid gallop, I thought, through the construction of the hero and some of the more morally ambiguous points I think you were really making by the examples you took of how the hero has been constructed. And your, actually, I thought, odd use of the 1930s as a point by using men's critique, by really rather conservative men, the poets and writers that you took actually were very conservative and somewhat, I think, morally ambiguous themselves in terms of their refusal about particular points of masculinity. And then your contrast, and I think it's partly to do with example, of American
heroes.
Clint Eastwood and Spielberg. And in fact, I think the Taking Schindler's List as a film, which I think is a fascinating film to look at, does seem to me to have a number of more complex incidents. I think the key incident in that film is actually the way Schindler versus the real Nazi deals with the woman who is about to be, the Jewish woman who is about to be raped by the Nazi. And Schindler's handling of that is morally interesting. So I think your constructions of the hero and the nature of masculinity perhaps needed some more subtle examples than that leap you took.
Yes, I know it's...
Britain and the American filmmaking.
Can I just say I'll take that point? Okay.
Right, here first and then Jim. And then.
Yeah, you keep attacking heroes, but surely you can't deny that in the past heroes have achieved a great deal of history. I'll give you one example. Last, you probably won't like this. Great Baroness Thatcher. She was a woman as well, and a hero. At this moment in time, political leaders all around the world are definitely non-heroes. And look at the messy state of the world is in right now. So I contest that point with you. Secondly, you say that women who succeed have to divorce themselves from sexuality. Well, that's common sense. It's the same for men. You can't be distracted by the issue of sex if you're pursuing the important things in life, like power and leading a nation. Again, I refer you to the example of Mrs. Thatcher. What's your answer to that?
Well, I think... is to turn it round and say that perhaps part of the problem about contemporary politicians is that they actually want to be heroes. I mean, I would actually see wanting to be a hero as a problem. It's not that they're just not. I mean, I think there'd be probably a lot of consensus around that issue. But wanting to be heroic is in itself a problem, and it's an issue which needs to be discussed. You mentioned Mrs. Baroness Thatcher. Well, of course... The point about she's only lately Baroness Thatcher. For a long time, she was Mrs. Thatcher, which was a particularly convenient mediation through masculinity of her presence as a woman.
So a convenient mediation, did you say?
Mediation. I mean, it was a way of translating what might have been something very straightforward and unacceptable into a married woman. I mean, and a married woman was acceptable.
Yes, you can't deny that Dennis Thatcher was never held in the same light or in the same attention as Mrs. Thatcher was. So on that grounds, I can't agree with you. And would you not accept Mrs. Thatcher as a feminine role model?
Right. Not easily.
Final point on this one.
Sorry.
Jim.
Yes, I wanted to move slightly from the discussion of heroes, and you talked about the media hanging on to the myth of the hero. I wonder if you had any thoughts on the way the media has created myths of certain female royals as heroines.
Well, I'm not sure that it has, really. I would like to ask you if you think they have actually been presented as heroines, because I think it's been a lot more ambiguous than that.
I think they have targeted certain members of the royal family. Lady Di is an obvious case, and there the sort of persona that comes over is somebody who has taken risks, like helping a tramp out of the serpentine just a couple of days ago, going to see AIDS victim, and so on. This is a kind of role model as
Well, I think heroism is a burden for both sexes, and it's clearly one which is being used as far as particular people are concerned. And if you actually read what happened in the incident that you're referring to carefully, I mean, it's clear that what she did was stand on the bridge while somebody else leapt into the water. And what that's exactly what I mean about the confusion of process and ideology. Asking your chauffeur to make a 999 call on your portable phone is then actually read as heroism. Well, I mean, that's very nice if that's how you want it to be translated. But it's precisely that kind of construction.
Yeah, at the back there first and then here.
So I just wanted to suggest that there may be, you may be underestimating women's, the long tradition of history of women's public moral presence and agency. And I think perhaps one of the best examples is the history of women's peace movement.
Yes.
It's definitely been a moral and a political force.
Yes, yes.
And one which is acting very explicitly as and for women.
I think that's right. And I mean, if there had been space to say more about that movement in the 20th century, anti-slavery in the 19th century, there are obviously a whole host of examples where you could look at it and you could say, well, exactly how was that constructed? Because it is absolutely the case that there was a considerable female presence there. But it's the how of its construction which seems to me to be interesting.
Mm. only one, and therefore you can put your own argument. If you could name lots and lots and lots of, you know, women and heroes, then I might be prepared to
I think I'd just like to make one comment about what you said about the ways in which the state relates to women. Because at one, on the one hand, what the state it's increasingly in the state's advantage to be gender blind. I mean, and you can see what's happening, that in the sense the state is sort of saying, well, everybody can goes out to work these days, etc., etc. So, I mean, there's a sense in which you feel almost that there is some point and some case to be made at the moment for maintaining traditional essentialism, because at least it doesn't force women into this phony freedom in which everything is exposed to be equal, we're all equal workers. And yet, of course, the reality of the situation is that that is not the case. I mean, it's a kind of false androgyny, if you like.
We've got two questions, one here, and then...
I'm not sure if I understood you properly, so when you started talking about the problem of representing femininity in a culture where masculinity is taken as the norm, I sort of get from that you think there are inherently natural things about women, which, you know, sort of qualities... define us, because I mean, later on in your introduction, you did mention that femininity was defined by men in the 20th century today, and that if you're accepting the idea that there are these kind of natural qualities that women have, how then do we fight for equality? Because surely we should have the power to define our own what we do. There's nothing, I don't think there's anything natural in me which should make me want to care for a child any more than a man should. So are you actually saying that there are these natural qualities within people? If so, I'd argue it would be very hard to fight for equality.
I think the answer to your question is I really don't know, quite honestly. I don't think, what I think is actually the case, whether the natural qualities or not, that's what I don't know. And I think almost at the moment that's fairly, what is natural is fairly unknowable. What I do think is the case, and what I would resist, would be the social construction of the natural, which it seems to me is something different. You know, in saying that women are naturally this, that or the other, in the same way that men are this, that or the other. So it's actually to separate the two things.
Go ahead. Sexual behavior to be somehow seen as an allowable basis for moral conflict. That aside, I think I come off a little bit too strongly in terms of sex not being relevant to morality. Clearly, relationships that involve exploitation of people are, I think, moral subjects, but it's because of the moral exploitation, practical exploitation, it's not because of the sex part.
Well, my first comment is that that issue of morality and sexuality seems to be an absolute minefield in, you know, in which it's very difficult to move and indeed to say anything helpful. And so other than that, I mean, I think where you'd have to start would be saying, well, why is it? Why do we find it so difficult to talk about that area? Why do we find it so difficult to decide what is exploitative, what is wrong, what is right? I mean, are those terms actually acceptable? Are they useful in terms of sexuality? I mean, should we just say, well, you know, should we look at it in a post-Foucault era? Should we look at it in other ways and investigate not sexuality, not the theme of sexuality, but themes of desire? And should we say, well, in terms of that theme, morality is simply, you know, inappropriate? So perhaps, you know, what we need to sort of discuss and, you know, talk about is actually what we're going to talk about.
Right, there's a question here, there, and then I'll take two more, that one and that one. Yeah, that's it, I think.
Okay.
Market economy, and so that is enough. And you don't have to focus specifically on the slave trade if you criticize the market economy, because you said that she examines the material effects of the social system on women. But I think, especially talking about slave trade, I think there are actually. There are very different effects on white and on black women.
Mm.
And apart from that, I also have to say that nowadays in Europe, and also before in Europe, and it has always been like that, for me as a white woman, I think it's easier to get a job than a black man.
Mm.
So as feminist as I am, I can't close my eyes concerning the color line.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's an important point. It's just that I wanted to defend Austin against the charge of being, in a sense, socially irrelevant because of that particular absence. Well, I think it would be nice to think that that was possible, but it seems to me that that's far too much of a global, universal process. I mean, given the gist of your remarks, which are about a particular institutional context, it just does seem to me that what one can contest, because it's relatively well demarcated, is institutions acting as moral agencies. And I mean, in terms of the health service, that would obviously be one area in which that those particular kinds of interventions could be questioned. So I think in those particular cases, there's obviously scope for challenging the ways in which institutional interventions are being made. In a wider sense, I'm not sure.
Right, this is the last question then coming here.
It seems that there must be two different things. That morality is some sort of prescription, either a prescription or a kind of this is right for me but not for anyone else, which is one way to see and give it. And politics is much more about strategies, coalitions, compromises, and advocacy. It's much more, they seem to me to be maybe two different things.
That's right, and to take, I mean, Carol Gilligan's work, I mean, seems to me to ask, is premised on the assumption that women think in different, have a different way of moral reasoning than men. I mean, that's part of her contention, and that is constructed in crucially in adolescence. I mean, that's where this different kind of moral reasoning starts to emerge. But I absolutely agree. I mean, politics is, as you say, about strategies, about the implementing particular policies, about getting your own way. What concerns me is the particular ways in which women are constructed as being capable of intervening in that particular area. You know, it's often very much more difficult for women to intervene in those areas than it is for men. And if they're going to intervene, on what kind of platform are they going to intervene? So, I mean, I think that it's right, the question of morality in politics is one which has to be discussed.
Well, that seems a wonderful point to stop on the question of the relationship between morality and politics, which is where we began. It just remains for me to thank Mary Evans very much for a wonderful lecture, and to invite you all to have a glass of wine with us. Thank you very much.